Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast, Kermode and Mayo's Film Review. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello and welcome to another podcast from 5 Live, which features me.
And me.
And it's pretty good this week. I think we're going to ramble through a couple of guests.
We've got Christopher Hampton, the famed screenwriter. We've got Joe Dante.
He has long grey hair, by the way.
Who, Joe Dante?
No,
Christopher Hampton. Joe Dante, who
looks like Tony Slattery, don't you think?
Oh, he does, doesn't he? I was trying to think who he reminded me of. Yeah, he does look like Tony Slattery. And reviews of My Son, What Hath Ye Done, the new Michael Shannon movie.
And if you think that's irritating when Mark says it there, you wait. By the time he's said it for the 16th time, you're going to be pulling your teeth out.
And The Runaways and Resident Evil 4 and Tomorrow Drew, which everyone else loves.
All coming up in this week's podcast. Welcome to 2 hours of Wittertainment. Featuring
Mark Kermode doing reviews of Tomorrow Drew, My Son, What Have Ye Done, Going the Distance, Cyrus, The Runaways, Evil, Resident Evil, Afterlife, and much, much more.
We're getting better. And also, screenwriter par excellence, Christopher Hampton, and Gremlins director Joe Dante on his new movie. All the reviews coming up, plus your participation. Mayo at bbc.co.uk. You can text 85058. Welcome to a couple of hours of film conversation. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm all right. That's very formal.
Good afternoon.
We don't usually do that sort of thing. Hello, Simon. How's your coffee that I've just
brought you? Oh, beautiful. Thank you. Mayo at bbc.co.uk. We start with some good news. Dr. Paul says, Dear Doctor and Erin Dawes, after all the talk about the loss of the projectionist as a contributing factor to the decline of the modern cinema franchise, here is some good news. Heroic projectionists still exist in Canada. We've been living in Ottawa for just over a year and enjoying the amazing Mayfair Theatre, home of many delights, including late-night horror and silent-era classics, complete with orchestra. Recently, at a Canadian cult 16mm double bill, disaster struck when an ailing print broke 5 minutes into the show.
Can I just say that I'm sure that if it's a Canadian cult 16mm double bill, they must have been playing the David Cronenberg early shorts.
The night was saved by the projectionist patching the film and then guiding the warped print by hand through the projector for the rest of the running time.
Brilliant.
This was a performance piece indeed and allowed us to enjoy the terrific crime wave in all its glory. So big thanks to all at the Mayfair and the Lost Dominion Collective for brilliant work keeping those old films playing. And well done, says Dr. Paul. I'm going to suggest that we go and do the show from the Mayfair Theatre in Ottawa.
I'm with you. I think that's a great idea.
I think it's probably the best idea I've had for a while. I'll see how that goes past the selection committee.
I feel the same way about the
apparently it's already gone through the selection
committee,
and the answer is no.
Great, we're going. Okay. I feel the same way about the projection thing as I do about when you and I used to broadcast at Radio 1 on tape, on quarter inch tape, and if something went wrong, you could literally just physically pull the tape through the machine. But if it's on a digital brick, you can't. You can't put your hand in and pull through the digits. It doesn't work.
Dear Kermode and Mayo, now this email from Alex Porter says, Dear Kermode and Mayo, and it says it for a reason. I've just listened to the podcast version of the film reviews from 3rd of September. I'm aware that it is an edit of the live show and that the news and travel have to be removed, but for some reason, instead of just softly editing it out, someone has chosen to pepper the podcast with someone shouting, Kermode and Mayo film reviews, or This is BBC Radio 5 Live, every 10 minutes at a volume considerably louder than the actual conversation. Arriving as this does without warning, it's remarkably irritating, if not dangerous, given that I usually listen in the car. As you both frequently complain of the dumbing down of Hollywood movies and the tendency audiences have to be treated like idiots... Mm. Quite surprised that the show thinks so little of its podcast listeners.
That
it has to remind them every 10 minutes what it is they're listening to and where it comes from. I know it's Kermode and Mayo's film reviews. I was the one who put it on my iPod. I also have an attention span long enough to remember this fact for the duration of the podcast and probably for considerably longer.
Can I also say on that subject,
can I just say, we've sorted it.
Have we? I'm sounding a little off mic, and I mention it only because you are sounding like, you know, fully rounded and fruity, like a wheelbarrow full of goodness, and I'm sounding a little bit reedy, a little bit tinny, and I just want to make sure that it's not...
This is normally an off-air conversation.
No, I want to be quite clear about this. What do you mean if I came in early enough? The station was on air.
It's your paranoia, Mark. This is good news from Robert in Edinburgh. to Werner Herzog and the Fluffy Penguins. Whilst browsing the IMDb the other day, this is the Internet Movie Database, which is a very good source of information and sometimes erroneous information.
The increasingly reliable Internet Movie Database, as I believe it's now known.
I decided to check out what Mark's favourite Antichrist, Michael Bay, was getting up to. Mm. In particular, there were three films in production that stood out, which were a remake of The Birds, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and, get this, 2012... Two, which makes it, by my reckoning, 20,122.
Oh, yes, of course it does, yes.
Yeah, if you put the comma in the appropriate place.
Very good.
Anyway, Robert says, I don't know quite know what he's going to do with the last one, as it is indeed slated for 2014, but it's going to be 2012 too.
But yeah, I mean, you know, what Michael Bay does with his spare time is anybody's business. I mean, we have the new Transformers movie to look forward to, and the only thing that's worth saying about that is that in the interim between the release of Transformers 2, which I rightly identified as one of the worst movies ever made, Michael Bay and Shia LaBeouf...
I mean, you're agreeing with yourself.
Yeah.
You're just checking the previous
what happened
review
then,
and saying you were right.
Is that Michael Bay and Shia LaBeouf, Sleepy LaBeef, Snoozy LaPork, the charisma vacuum that is Mr. LaBeouf, have all confessed that actually Transformers 2 was rubbish. I mean, they've all said, yes, we dropped the ball a little bit. We had too many... It was just robots hitting each other. We didn't rein the elements in. All the things that... You know, I said we're wrong with it.
No, they never actually said it was just robots hitting each other, because that's a direct quote from your review.
Shia LaBeouf said, if you take all the characters and all the stuff out, it is just robots hitting each other.
Maybe he listens.
Yeah, that's kind of unlikely. But it's one of those things that... what I wonder is it worse when somebody like Michael Bay makes a movie that he knows is grievous and horrible and total toilet? Or is it actually better if, like Ed Wood, he genuinely has no idea? I mean, I think the knowledge that he's making the worst movies ever made by anyone ever somehow just compounds his guilt. I think he does know how bad they are.
What would be the worst possible thing for today's programme is if Christopher Hampton, screenwriter and director par excellence, was now to say, well, actually, I've just been slated to write the new Michael Bay
movie.
Yeah,
but you know what? The thing is, it hasn't happened. You know why? Because Christopher can write. So consequently, it's like that old joke about it. Why do they call writers? Because they're right. Michael Bay, you'd last 2 seconds in a meeting with Michael Bay. Hey, what have you written before? What? Carrington? Never heard of it. Get out.
Well, he could always say...
You're not making a movie with Michael Bay, are you?
I'm not. Good. No plans to.
Do come in a little closer, Christopher.
Okay.
How are you?
Very good, thanks.
See, he sounds better on mic than I do. Have I been given the reedy mic?
No, you're just more paranoid than ever. That's the truth of it. Christopher is here because we are going to celebrate the art of screenwriting. This is a BFI initiative. Tell us what's happening, Christopher.
Yes, several screenwriters have been invited to hold forth, really, about what they do and why they do it, which is very, very... surprising thing to happen for a screenwriter, so we're all very
why?
Pleased.
Well, why is it surprising?
Generally speaking, we're the great overlooked.
Why is that?
It's always traditional. It's traditional. The writer has always been bottom of the totem pole in the in first on and usually first off a film.
You are the Expendables.
Yes, I think so. I think that there's a widespread belief in Hollywood, or has been for a long time, that if you get eight writers, it's eight times as good as getting one writer. So you have to sort of inure yourself to ups and downs, getting fired, having big rows, all that sort of thing.
But clearly, before Dr. Kerbo comes on and complains again about his microphone, let's take a Toman. You are clearly not the bottom of the row, because you wanted to do it, but you were clearly brought on because here is an extremely complex
unfilmable book.
And you were the man. And lots of people wanted to do it, but you were chosen. You were top of the heap, surely.
Well, that was an exception. I mean, and that was one of the few jobs I've ever actually gone after. That's to say, when I read the book, I phoned my agent and said, I want to write. I can see that this would make a very good movie. And can I please be considered?
What would be a more typical example, then, if you were to say, from personal experience, that would illustrate perfectly the way the movie industry looks at the screenwriter?
Well, there's a novel called, a very good novel by Deborah Mogatch called Tulip Fever. And I was, I think, the third writer to be hired to write that. And wrote, a couple of drafts and was actually rather happy with what I'd done. Was taken out to Los Angeles. Hung around for several days because I think they were making a Lara Croft Tomb Raider at the time.
Well, you had about 16 screenwriters.
You weren't involved with that one.
I wasn't involved with that one. So I hung around. Finally, there was a 40-minute meeting over lunch, and I had some notes. And I went back and I thought, well, I don't think much of these notes. One or two things occurred to me. So I made very few changes and sent the script back. And then I got a call saying they're very, very disappointed that you haven't done any work. And I said, well, you know, we had one 40-minute meeting in which most people's mouths were full of steak sandwich. And I didn't think anybody said anything very interesting. So they said, you're fired. And not long after that, I ran into Tom Stoppard, who said that he'd been asked if he would do Tulip Fever. And he hoped I didn't mind. I said, of course I don't mind. If it's not you, it'll be some other bugger.
Yes. But presumably, once you have Academy Award winner after your name, which you got for Dangerous Liaison, I mean, that makes a difference. That makes you top of... Surely that makes
I
you
thought
higher,
it did.
Higher
know,
up yeah. the pile than some directors. First-time directors, for example.
I thought it did, and I think I was wrong, because the story I've just told you happened long after.
Oh, okay.
Dangerous Liaison.
So were you ever tempted to say, don't you know who I am?
No, that's...
I'm Barton Fink.
Gets you absolutely nowhere.
See this Academy Award
listen,
I have?
Actually, I feel slightly nostalgic, for when I started the very first time, one of the first scripts I did was a script based on Edward II by Christopher Marlowe. And I did it for an American company. And I wrote the script in iambic pentameter, as the play is. And I had a meeting with, I can't say half of what was said to me, a meeting with this man who wound up hurling the script across the room at me and summarily firing me because I'd written the screenplay in verse. As the play was written. So I kind of have a nostalgia for those old days, actually, when people screamed and yelled. Nowadays it's very, very silken and corporate and you don't hear much. And you have to sometimes just infer that you've been fired.
Can I ask you a specific question about screenwriting and control over the product? There was a book published a couple of years ago by David Thompson, The Whole Equation, in which, I don't know whether you've read it, but he
yes,
did it.
Yes, I have.
There's a very interesting thing that's central to his thesis. I mean, he talks about a lot of things to do with Hollywood, but he has a sort of central idea, which is that at a key moment, the difference between what happened with writers and directors is that the Directors Guild held out for artistic control, whereas the Writers Guild held out for money and credit. And Thompson, in that very sort of Thompsonian way, says, in essence, this is the heart of the problem. The problem is that writers, at a crucial moment in the evolution of movies, said what we want is to be paid and to be credited, but what they didn't fight for was any form of control. And consequently, since then, you've had a movie industry in which the writing is actually the least respected part of the creative process, whereas directors actually do contractually have a right, for example, to deliver first cut. But the studio at no point, or very rarely, has to go to the writer and say, this is a cut, what do you think of it?
Absolutely right, and I'm sure that thesis is correct. And I think that writers, to some extent, have themselves to blame for the situation they've got into. I mean, the whole business of last-minute rewrites, for which people are paid an absolutely astonishing amount of money. You know, 2 weeks before shooting, they'll bring another writer in to rewrite the whole thing. I think writers should think carefully before they do that kind of thing, just because that contributes to... I mean, I know, you know, it's money in the bank, but it does contribute to people feeling that the writer is expendable or interchangeable or somehow not really part of the process once the piece of paper is handed over.
We have Christopher Hampton here discussing screenwriting. Now, what exactly is happening? What are BAFTA and BFI offering in London, Christopher?
Well, there are six screenwriters who are coming on evenings, starting... The first one was yesterday, David Hare, yesterday. I think everybody's been given a pretty broad brief. We can talk about what we like. I'm choosing to talk about something that I've particularly been involved in over the last years, and that is adapting really good books, adapting masterpieces, which is generally held to be a less sensible thing to do than adapting bad books.
But didn't you start with an Ibsen play? Wasn't that yours?
It was my... That
you
my,
start low, you know. My very, the bar.
My very first screenplay that was made was a, was a, 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 I had done a translation of A Doll's House by Ibsen, and it caught the wave of Women's Lib, I think, at the beginning of the 70s, and so moved from the stage to the screen. I think it was probably the cheapest film made in England since the war, but it was wonderfully distinguished cast. Claire Bloom and Anthony Hopkins and Ralph Richardson and Edith Evans, so it wasn't a bad start.
If we were to watch you at work, what would we see? I'm interested in the process because over the summer I was reading Stephen King's book On Writing, which is part memoir and part This Is How I Write, in which he explains what works best for him. What is it that works best for you? Because I think I'm right in saying you write longhand with a pen and lined paper.
Yeah, I write longhand into big black books I buy from Ryman's, and I leave one page blank for revisions.
One page per page?
Yes, each double page, one page is blank.
That would be the way to do it. They're handing the script with just one page. Any changes you want, if they don't fit on that page, they're not going. That's what the script looks like.
Yes, and I try to... I sort of potter around in the morning and look at what I wrote yesterday and see if I want to change it or modify it in any way, and then I really get going about 2 in the afternoon.
But if you're adapting a book, do you have the book open as you're doing it, or do you read the book and then sit down and just do it from memory?
I read the book 2 or 3 times, and then I write my own synopsis of it, again in a sort of notebook, and on the facing page I write images and things that seem important in the book and things that I don't want to leave out. Because, of course, one of the things you have to do when you're adapting from a novel is just wholesale throw away a huge chunk of it because of obvious time reasons. So you've got to choose what bits of rock to throw away.
And what sort of stuff, if you can generalise, gets thrown out?
It's generally stuff to do with minor characters that you can see will not fit into the sort of dramatic. It's hard to generalise because different books have different problems. But it's generally the quirkier stuff, I suppose, or the stuff that deviates from the plot, because you want to keep driving down the road.
There are writers who adapt from books by underlining lines of I mean, I've seen annotated, books in which people have gone through that. It sounds to me like you don't do that because you don't actually have the book open at the point that you're writing.
No, I don't do that. And also, it's very rare that writers of prose actually write dialogue that actors can comfortably speak. Take an extreme example is Joseph Conrad, who I've done a couple of adaptations of, completely unspeakable dialogue. sometimes, I mean, Ian McEwan is pretty good, and sometimes, I adapted a book of Malcolm Bradbury's called The History Man, and his dialogue was excellent, and so I found myself using that quite a lot. Or actually, what annoyed Malcolm was I found myself slightly misremembering it and slightly paraphrasing it.
And what about when you're adapting your own work, as in Dangerous Liaisons?
Well, then you have to be really ruthless. Because the very first screenplay I ever wrote was an adaptation of my first stage play, which was called When Did You Last See My Mother? And I really didn't know what to do except to sort of copy it out again. And the result was...
It sounds like a punishment in an English
lesson. Yes, quite. But it was paid for, fortunately. But the script, I'm embarrassed about the script I handed in because it hadn't really rethought the thing in terms of the difference between the theatre and movies, which is enormous, I think. Really, really radical. I mean, fortunately, Stephen Frears, who I worked with on Dangerous Liaison, was not a man who is very keen on the theatre and is rendered extremely anxious by scenes of longer than a page, or speeches of longer than a paragraph. So, we made sure that the movie... Between us, we made sure that the movie was nothing like the stage play in the sense that it didn't smell of the theatre.
If you spend the morning padding around and checking what you'd done the day before, isn't the computer designed for editing much better than writing longhand in a Ryman's folder?
Starting to use the computer to do subsequent drafts or rewrites. Towards the latter end of the process, but I really like to, I mean I I'm I don't I'm not wholly comfortable with the computer yet.
Can you think of a movie which adequately portrays the writer's dilemma? I mean, when I think of movies about screenwriting, I think of Barton Fink, which I think is the great film about screenwriting, or something like The Player, in which the writer is completely dumped upon and actually ends up threatening to kill the movie bosses. Is there a movie which adequately portrays what it's like to be a screenwriter?
Well, you know, Sunset Boulevard is takes some beating, and that's a film where the design of the film is absolutely key to the writer's voiceover has been beautifully integrated into the whole story, and it is a film about the desperate end of screenwriting.
Was Atonement the most difficult book you have adapted? I know it's a slightly different case in point, as you said at the beginning, because you read it and you rang up and you wanted the job, but was it as difficult as everyone said it was going to be?
It was, in the sense, and it took a lot of time for, I mean, there fortunately was a lot of time because we had two directors and the whole process spread out over 3 or 4 years. But it wasn't the most difficult script I've had to do, no. I think the one I did next, which was called Cherie, which I thought was going to be easy, turned out to be ferociously difficult.
And what was the difficulty of Atonement? Because obviously in the book what happens is that the narrative voice sort of splits and you get given two possible ways that the story could go. Is that the thing that was the most difficult? Because I'm thinking, for example, of how they managed to do that with French Lieutenant's Woman, of having the two interweaving.
Can I just say before you answer that, if you want to be more butch on this programme, can you speak into the microphone rather than at Christopher?
I was speaking at him, I was speaking to him.
Therefore, you were becoming almost inaudible.
I beg your pardon. Right. I believe you heard the question, Christopher.
That's because you were looking at
it. Okay, fine. I'll ask him again. I was saying, was the difficulty, because in the book, I'm saying this into the microphone, in the Book of Atonement, there is the narrative voice splits, and there's a version of events which is this could have happened, and there's a version of events which is this did happen. In the same way that when they adapted The French Lieutenant's Woman, the way that was done was by having, you know, there was a film, with, and then the real... Was that the thing that was so difficult?
I'll tell you the process that we went through, which was, you know, to start with, I actually was quite radical with the book and made a lot of changes. And as script succeeded script, or draft succeeded draft, I started moving closer and closer back to the book, and eventually got right back to the book, almost too close to it. And to deal with these very difficult things that, you know, with two things happening simultaneously to two different characters, we invented something which I called the flash sideways, which isn't quite how it happens in the book, but you see a thing through one person's eyes, and then you return back to the first image of the sequence, and you then see it through the eyes of... it's actually very, very simple, but it's one of those simple things that didn't occur to any of us till we'd all driven each other crazy about how we were going to make this clear to the audience.
So when you worked long and hard on Atonement or any of the other films, Christopher, when there are so many films now which start off by saying a film by...
Un film de.
Yeah, and it's the director's name.
Yes.
And clearly... He's the main guy or the main woman on the picture, but it implies that he has authored it as well.
Well, we have to blame the French.
Yes, let's do that in general.
Yes, we have to blame the French. We can do that whenever possible, because they started it all. I know Stephen Frears very well, and he was quite sort of heroic about it. He refused to say a film by, until quite recently when he finally said, well, everyone else is saying a film by, so... You know, why don't... And in fact, any film really is by the director, you have to say, in the end.
And you have directed, so maybe
yes.
You...
Yes. I think writer's contribution is probably more important than most people perceive. But in the end, all the final decisions are to do with... the director. I've just done a film with David Cronenberg.
Yes, I have a question on that.
Yes, well, he's an extremely nice man to work with, but you never lose sight of the fact that he's the director. So he will listen to what you have to say, and he will either accept it but he'll go his own way. The film is going to be a David Cronenberg film.
Yes, I mean, it's an email from Will Chadwick, so that makes it... En question de Will Chadwick. Could you ask Christopher about working with David Cronenberg on adapting the upcoming Dangerous Method for him? How did it compare working with David Cronenberg to any other director?
Well, he was very... first of all, he contacted me because he had read... Dangerous Method is based on a play I wrote called The Talking Cure. And it came and it went. And then I was very delighted 3 or 4 years later to have a call from David Cronenberg saying that he'd read the play and he thought it made the basis of an interesting film. And what happened was, We talked about it. I wrote the first draft. I went to Canada, where he lives, Toronto, to see him. And we had a meeting which lasted, I think, under 2 hours, in which he listed with great lucidity exactly what scenes he liked, what scenes he wanted to cut. And rather disconcertingly, at one point, he said, this is a very good scene, but it's not the kind of scene I can direct well, so we'd better take it out.
Good for him for being so upfront.
Yeah,
so,
which, of course, brilliant also, because there's no answer to it. You say, I've got to take it out.
and it makes it his fault.
And then I did another draft, and then he sent me a draft in which, exactly the same, except that he had cut about 8 pages. And he said, I like to do the editing before rather than after. And I was shocked at first, but when I read it, I saw that he'd done it really well and tightened it well. And so I wrote to him and said, I absolutely agree with everything you've done. Could we please put back 2 things? To which the email reply came, no.
and that's it.
And there we were. But it couldn't have been a nicer experience working with him.
And final question from Steve in Bilderston in Suffolk. With regard to adaptation, would you ask Christopher if he considers it a craft rather than an art and therefore a lesser form?
It's a very interesting question. It generally is regarded as a lesser form than original writing. And it certainly is a craft. But I don't think it's any easier than writing an original screenplay. Certainly I've not found it so. I suppose I haven't really... Carrington was what you might call an original screenplay. That was, no more difficult to do than Atonement. Equally, the David Cronenberg script, which relied on... It was a historical piece, so relied an enormous amount on research, was also just as difficult to do as adapting Conrad, for example.
But as you yourself said, actually, the trick of it is to adapt something that's really trashy, so that people then go back to the original novel and go, the amazing thing is that it's all from the screenplay. Whereas if you're facing a really, really famous, well-known, well-loved book, you're always going to, you know, come in for the, well, it's all in the book.
That's right, but that, you know, so therefore you do need to be, I suppose, have a certain degree of self-effacingness in it. In other words, what you set out to do is somehow translate this great book into some equivalent experience in the cinema. That's quite enough for me, I think. If you can get close to that, you know, doing that's just as important, just as satisfying to me as doing something completely original, I think.
Christopher Hampton, really appreciate you coming in. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Indeed. Screenwriters on Screenwriting is from BAFTA, and the BFI Screenwriters Lecture Series, which is in London, goes on to the 23rd of September. Your one is tonight, though.
It is tonight.
Can people still get tickets? And
I'm told that they have got some extra seats somehow or other.
Knocked out a wall.
Or maybe moved to somewhere larger. So they might be, but I wouldn't swear to it.
Christopher, thanks very much indeed for coming in. Appreciate
Pleasure.
That. Joe Dante will be here at some stage. You know, he's on his way. Dear Barry and Paul, this is James in London. Barry and Paul.
That's the Chuckle Brothers.
Yes. Or it could be Paul and Barry Ryan, singers.
Much more likely to be Barry and Paul the Chuckle Brothers.
Do you think?
I do, yes. Particularly since we've talked about the Chuckle Brothers. But
Paul and Barry Ryan were quite good.
I like the Chuckle Brothers.
They did the original... Paul,
to me,
Barry
to you,
Ryan did
to you,
the,
to
yeah,
me.
Eloise, that was him.
Oh, was it?
Barry Ryan, yeah.
I just remember the Damned doing that.
Anyway, James says, I'm trying to get through a whole box of Jaffa Cakes before the end of your show. Mm-hmm. I call this biscuitainment, but it depends how you classify Jaffas. Thought you should know. I'll tell you how it went in the end. I've just eaten my fourth.
Apparently, Jaffa Cakes have very few bad things in them, or at least this is what my sister assures me as she eats them.
Matthew says about Mark's grievance on Transformers and Shia LaBeouf and Michael Bay, I've not seen Revenge of the Fallen, but if you take the characters out of it, it would have to be just
robots hitting each other.
If we took the characters out of This Happy Breed, we'd just have an empty semi-detached house.
He didn't mean that they literally take the characters out. He meant that the characters have nothing to do other than run around between the robots hitting each other. Although, let's face it, Transformers was never going to be character-led.
Rose, BSc Zoology, MSc Museum Studies, Dublin. Mm. First time listening live.
Yeah.
Live streamed as well as the lights are on. if you want to watch the gorgeousness of this programme. Yes, Mark, you do sound a little reedy and whistly. You sound like you're deliberately feigning a high-pitched whinge, so please don't do your Danny Dyer impression. You might break everyone's ears.
Are you looking at me in order to humorously do it? I'm not doing it on cue. I'm not just a trained dog, you know.
Performing tart. Kurt van der Bash. This is last week we were talking about Liev Schreiber.
Yes.
He is in Salt. By the way, if you want to do a pithy...
Leave or live?
Well, exactly the point. Kurt says it is pronounced Liev to rhyme with he have.
Really?
It's Liev Schreiber. I know, says Kurt, because I storyboarded his directing debut, Everything is Illuminated. From Kurt in Prague, I once corrected Mark's singing of the Star Trek theme, minor seventh, remember?
Oh, yes, yes.
He says. So it's Liev Schreiber.
I quite like Next Everything is Illuminated. It's a very strange film with the guy in it, he's not Russian, but he's vaguely Slavic in that way. He says that, I am such a... All the women want to be with me because I am such a premium dancer.
Is that a vaguely Slavic accent?
Yeah. Bumby bumby.
We could do with pithy reviews via text or email for Salt, The Expendables, Piranha 3D, and Grown Ups. Oh, actually, Joe Dante, of course, did Piranha.
Piranha, yeah.
So
2D.
2D, and his new movie is in 3D, so he would be quite a good person to discuss Piranha 3D.
And can I say before we go any further, I was going to see Scott Pilgrim vs. the World on Tuesday, and then I was made to go and see Into the Void, the Gaspar Noé film, instead, because they needed something doing me, so I still haven't seen Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, so I'm afraid I can't put that one to bed yet. I will try and see it again next week. But the problem is, at the moment, there's 9 films coming out a week, plus the Gaspar Noé made the 10, and I did want to see Scott Pilgrim, but the Gaspar Noé was a head scrambler, to be sure.
Do you know who? Oh, we could check this with Joe when he arrives. Who we have to thank for Piranha 2D?
Well, James Cameron, you mean?
No.
Go what?
No, I don't mean that. Steven Spielberg.
Right.
Because apparently, so the story, because it was just after Jaws, and the studio thought, I think we need to shut this one down, because they've taken all our ideas, and Spielberg said, no, I think it's an homage.
Yeah, so no, but that's fine. But that's the standard Roger Corman thing about what is a Roger Corman movie if not a Jaws movie? What is Jaws if not a Roger Corman movie with a budget? So the question was, what is Piranha if not a Steven Spielberg movie without a budget?
Bob in Dundee. Dear Doctors Evil and X's, delighted to have you back. Despite the Oids doing a fine job in your absence, I'd go so far as to say they did an excellent job if they'd lower themselves to a spot of petty bickering now and then. Really meant to write in last week, but I was hoping at least one of my colleagues might save me the trouble. We have a handful of Kermode fans up here in Dundee who spent a good year or two toiling away on the less glamorous aspects of The Illusionist. Not that there's much glamour in any area of animation, finding brief respite from the tedium in the shape of your podcast. This was the first feature film any of us had worked on, and of course the big payoff we'd been looking forward to, short of the Oscar, was a mention on the show. Needless to say, we were devastated to miss out on a Kermode review. Any chance he could say a few words to give us some closure, or is he waiting for the 3D version?
No, I still need to see The Illusionist. The strange thing was that when The Illusionist was happening, this is a Sylvain Chomet film that's based on the unfilmed screenplay by Jacques Tati. In advance of it
and
coming
using,
out,
clearly the finest animators
known to mankind
in Dundee.
I received, as I'm sure a number of people did, these angry letters from the Tati estate saying how terrible it is that people are animating Jacques Tati and who do they think they are. And it's really odd. I've still got them. I've still got these really bizarre letters saying, oh, you know, l'outrage. And what is French for outrage? But I'm really looking forward to it. I'm really, you know, looking forward to it very much.
Good. Okay. Well,
I have to see Scott Pilgrim first.
So Bob in Dundee, you know, that's the way it is at the moment. He can't really give you closure because
I haven't seen it yet, and never review a film you haven't seen.
John Pierce, my daughter Rebecca is just about to start her third and final year of a natural science degree course at Cambridge. She tells me now the world's number one university.
What is Cambridge?
Cambridge.
What do you mean now the world's? No, isn't that just always? Been
it was Harvard, but
was it?
Yeah, but it's now Cambridge. Why do you make a silly noise like that?
Because I went to Manchester and you went to, where was it?
Durham.
Warwick. Fine, exactly. Cambridge, world's number one university. Sorry.
There speaks the class warrior.
Yeah.
Just because Cambridge is better than Manchester?
I've got an O level in English. I'm going to have an A level in French.
I apologise for this petulant and childish outburst from someone who really frankly should know better.
I'm sorry, I'm at Cambridge. I can't do studying at the moment. I'm too busy punting. Hello, Joe.
That was a nice inclusive moment for the audience. That being Joe Dante, who's just walked in. Hello, Joe. How are you?
I'm fine. I just ran all the way from London.
Did you go to Cambridge University, Joe?
No, I didn't.
See,
He's in the middle of a hysterical and childish outburst just because this listener, John, has a daughter who's at Cambridge, which I just said in passing has been declared the world's number one university. And because he didn't go there, he's now full of kind of petty stupidity.
Well, he's disadvantaged.
Exactly. Thank you.
Where did you get your higher education?
Well, I went to the Philadelphia College of Art, which is now known as the University Museum.
And has that given you a chip on the shoulder the way Manchester clearly has for Mark?
No, it's not that highly rated a school.
No. But you've done quite well with yourself.
Yes, frankly, I didn't really learn much there. I went to the movies all the time.
Anyway, let me just conclude this email from John. But as I conclude, I barely started. I apologise, John, and to Rebecca for Mark's ridiculousness. She tells me that Dr. K will be appearing at the Cambridge Picture House.
I will, yes.
Now, this is going to cause you... Because when you go to the Cambridge Picture House, just have a guess. How many do you think will be students at this... Ooh, Cambridge, I'm going to Cambridge, I'm going
hunting. Can I just say...
How many do you think?
Most of them. The comment was precipitated by you saying, the best university in the world.
Well, I didn't go there. I'm just saying it has been declared...
the best university in the world? What does that mean? On what terms is any university the best university in the world? It's a stupid thing to say.
Is the show always like this?
Yes, yeah, it is, really. Unfortunately.
He's not usually this bad, though. She tells me Dr. K will be appearing at the Cambridge Picture House next week, but sadly this is before she's due back on campus. Ash has just been appointed film and TV editor for the Cambridge Student Newspaper and is a big fan of Dr. K's work, past tense I think being appropriate. This is disappointing. It's her birthday next Tuesday and I would know you guys have big hearts. Could the doctor please say hello to Rebecca Pierce? And I think you should probably apologise to her and all the other people who have already got their tickets.
Hello to Rebecca Pierce. I apologise for any offence that may have been caused by the phrase "the best university in the world." I'm sorry, you can't say that about any university. It's a ridiculous thing to say. It's the best university in the world.
The top staff who work on this show will find me what the report was, where it came from, and how indeed they have judged.
I mean, I'm sure Cambridge is wonderful.
Cambridge is better than
Harvard. I know it is.
Harvard.
I know many people who go there. Number one, it's a lovely place and it's fabulous, and I have many friends who went there, and my parents went there, and blah, 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 you know.
Don't think you're getting involved, Dante. You're just here just to sit there and look great, okay?
No, I find it fascinating. It's good. Like another culture.
But Manchester's the best university in the world, and that's the end of that.
Good. Okay, I'm just staying aloof. Because I think you'll find Warwick.
Because you went to Warwick.
This is Five Live. Joe Dante is here. His new movie is Hole in 3D. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Is in 3D part of the title?
It became part of the title. It used to be just the Hole. But I see now it's the Hole 3D, which is fine. You know, there's Piranha 3D, which also isn't really part of the title. That's all really an advertising slogan.
And
on the
film,
it just says Piranha.
While you were legging it here as fast as you managed, we've already mentioned that Piranha 2D, that was you. That was your film.
Yeah, it was me.
Okay, so the Hole, let's start with that. Mark hasn't seen it. I have seen it. Just set the scene for us. It's nice to have you back directing movies. Just explain about the Hole.
Well, The Hole is a movie about a family, a dysfunctional family of a mom and two kids, one older, one younger, and two boys. And they move from a big city to a small podunk town, which is no fun. Kids are kind of bored and sullen about the reasons for moving. We don't quite know what they are, but they seem to be a little dark. And although they meet the girl next door, who's sort of a bright spot, they're kind of aimless, and they're downstairs in their basement, their new basement, and they discover a hole in the floor, which has numerous locks on it. And this being a horror film and them being kids, they make it their business to open up the hole. And, of course, again, this being a horror movie, when you open up the hole, stuff comes out, bad stuff.
So what can you tell us about... I mean, clearly this is the mystery that unfolds through the film. What can you tell us any more about what might be there?
I can only tell you that when I read the script, and I read a lot of these type of films, what struck me was that the solution to the mystery, what is in the hole, was completely unexpected by me. It went in a direction that I really didn't expect it to go, and a direction that turned out to be a little more dramatic and poignant than we would expect from a movie like this. So it seemed to me that that coupled with the fact that it's a slightly retro version of the kind of movies that I was making in the 80s, I thought, well, you know, maybe I am the right guy to do this.
Yes, and those films you're referring to, Gremlins 2, Inner Space and so on. So we're back in that area of, I mean, you called it a horror film. It has a 12A certificate. So it's, could you describe it as a family horror film?
I mean, well, the idea was supposedly, there's a dark undercurrent in the movie, and there's a very dark subplot in the picture, which we agonized about how explicit to be, because like all movies that are good family movies, there's a level on which the adults can watch it, and there's another level on which the kids watch it. And if you're subtle enough, and you can get a lot of things through to the adults that don't necessarily get picked up by the kids. So it's a level kind of a thing. You want to make a picture that adults can enjoy and a movie that kids can enjoy, because if the adults think it's just for kids, they'll just drop them off and not go, and you don't make any money. So you have to try to appeal to teenagers, older teenagers, and adults all at the same time. And it's tricky because the ages of the kids it's one of the reasons why movies top off at a certain point. Later they look back and they say, well, the problem with this movie was the kids were too young. We should have made them older. But then the problem is, if you made the kids older, the actions in the script are written for younger kids, and therefore it doesn't make sense because the kids aren't acting correctly. So it's always a trick. You're combining what your artistic aspirations are with what your box office needs.
It should be said, in terms of 12A certificate horror, one of the scariest movies ever made, George Sloyer's original version of The Vanishing, is a 12A certificate, and that film scared the life out of me.
Because?
Well, because it's incredibly scary. But it's a 12A certificate. There's nothing explicit in it. I mean,
it's scary because it's intense. And that's always the issue in America about ratings, when you're trying to get a rating for a film and not have an R but get a PG-13. How intense is the movie? It's often not what you show necessarily or anything explicit, but if the intensity of it, and of course as a filmmaker, the intensity is what you want. Mm-hmm. You want to make the film intense. So there's always this question of, you know, what do you have to trim, or what is there a suggestion that you have to not make in order for the picture to be supposedly approved by a group of psychiatrists or whoever these people are who make these ratings.
I mean, I think I'm interested that you said teenagers, older teenagers and adults, because if it's a 12A, anyone can go as long as they're accompanied by an adult. And we often get emails and texts about this. I would say, I mean, if I was 10 and I went to see this film, it would scare the living daylights out of me. I mean, it is really, I think it's too much for, I would say, an average 10-year-old. I don't know.
Well, I had that problem with Gremlins. I mean, there was a lot of issues when Gremlins came out. There was a scene where the mother puts a gremlin on the microwave and it splats. And
that's just funny.
There was that's what I thought. But then a lot of parents were saying, well, you know what's going to happen. My kid is going to see it and he's going to put his little sister in the microwave and he's going to microwave her. And that's
of course, parenting.
Well, it is, but that's obviously never happened. It reminds me of the story when some mother went up to Alfred Hitchcock and said, "My daughter won't take a shower since she saw Psycho," and he said, "Send her to the dry cleaners," because these things are people don't give children enough credit. I mean, kids are smarter than people think they are. They always have been, and now they're not only smarter, but they're more worldly, certainly than I was when I was a kid. The kind of movies that kids watch, particularly horror movies. You know, you can give it any certificate you want, but when it finally comes out in video, they're going to go to the kid next door's house and they're going to watch it.
It is worth pointing out that Gremlins is still a 15 certificate in the UK for exactly those sequences.
Although I think it's actually, I mean, maybe it's because I saw it when I didn't have kids and I watched The Hole having kids, but I think The Hole is scarier than Gremlins. Because
from your lips to the box office's ear.
Because as soon as Gremlins, as soon as the Gremlin turns out, I go, okay, fine, it's a monster film, it's fine, it's not going to happen. Not for one moment, but there is something about the hole in your basement. You're going to think, yeah, I reckon what if there is a hole in there? What if it goes on forever?
Well, it's a worst fears movie. I mean, the way that the picture works is that you actually, unlike some horror movies, you actually give some time off to character development so that you can relate to who these kids are, so that when the movie turns out to be about their worst fears, they're fears that the audience can identify with.
And 3D, because...
3D because when I was given the script, I thought this is a lovely movie, but it's a little small. It doesn't have a lot of characters. It doesn't have a lot of locations. And a lot of it takes place in the basement of the house where the kids live. And I thought, you know, this could look too small. If we do it in 3D, we not only can make it a bigger movie and seem to expand it, but also because so much of it is psychological, we can actually use it to instead of throwing things at the audience, to actually bring the audience into the picture, to make, and some people who've seen the movie tell me they feel like they're in the basement with the kids, because the movie sort of wraps around them And it's a matter of how you use the 3D. There's a lot of different ways to do it. But the best way is when you immerse the audience into something and they sort of forget that it's in 3D.
So when you look back at something like, you know, Matinee, in which it's talking about, you know, William Castle and all the jiggery-pokery that he did, you know, with skeletons flying out and smell-o-vision and buzzers in the seats and the rest of it, and it always seemed to me that your attitude to that stuff was that you were entertained and enchanted by it. But you also, you know, you saw it for what it was, which was carnival showmanship. The fact is, we're all being told that the cinema is going 3D. That is the future. And I am terribly worried about that. I don't want cinema to all look like that.
Well, because of that, it won't. Even if 3D is goes on, which there's some question as to whether it will, because of all the crappy fake 3D movies now that are giving it a bad name.
And when you say fake 3D, you mean the ones that aren't shot
in 3D. Movies that weren't shot in 3D and were never intended to even be seen in 3D and are not cut correctly for 3D and are not composed correctly for 3D, but are nonetheless sent off to India and come back in some sort of faux 3D.
We established that the word that is required is dimensionalized.
No, the word is retrofitted.
Okay, anyway.
Well, the point is that these pictures are not making audiences happy, and they may turn off on the entire idea of 3D. But I think that when 3D is used correctly in an appropriate film, not every film, no Dinner with Andre in 3D, it can be a useful storytelling tool, much like CinemaScope became, color, you know, all these other advancements. And I agree with you. The whole advent of 3D TV is something they talk about. Well, everybody's TV is going to be in 3D. I don't want to watch the news in 3D. You know, it's not going to happen. People aren't going to want to watch 3, 4, 5, 6 hours of 3D. It's too much. It's too hard. So I think when it's appropriate, I think 3D is a useful tool. I don't think it means that every movie that's produced needs to get sent to India and come back in this phony 3D process.
I mean, I would say it is appropriate in this. I mentioned this last week. When I went to see Toy Story 3D, I felt cross about the 3D because it was pointless. I just didn't. There was just no point. They just charged me more money for some glasses. When I went to see Hole, I did see the point. There was more point to your 3D than there is in Toy Story. So
I think that's because when we started out to make the picture, we thought, okay, we're making a 3D movie, which of course also has to work in 2D. The Toy Story movies are lovely movies, but they're not. The 3D is just an ancillary idea. It's like, oh, and we'll do that too, because it's so easy to do in the computer. All you do is punch a button, and all of the creations that you have are now seen from a different angle, and it's much easier to do than shoot live action 3D.
Joe Dante is here. His new movie is The Hole in 3D, and let's just finish with this, taken from The Guardian, your paper of choice, Mark.
Don't look at me.
Cambridge ousts Harvard as world's best university. This according to the QS World University Rankings, derived from a survey of 15,000 academics based on measures of research quality, graduate employability, teaching, and how international the faculties and student bodies are. That's where it comes from.
Southampton and Manchester are where it's at.
Based on?
Me.
There you go. I know what I'd rely on. Now, there's an interesting email, just Joe. This actually came in for us, but I think you're the perfect man. Let's discuss this because it's an interesting one from Jeff.
He actually thinks you're the perfect man. That's as far as he was going with that.
Jeff Fowler.
Who's to argue?
BA English Literature, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, which doesn't register
second-rate
at all.
University.
Given the inevitable, just picking up on the 3D conversation which we're having because Hole is in 3D, given the inevitable technological advancements we're all going to be subjected to over the coming decades, do you think it is possible that the headaches, the dollhouse problems associated with 3D might be solved? Perhaps a hyper-sharp, super-bright projector, LCD screen operated by a first-gen Terminator, blah, blah, blah. And 3D film is simply a nascent medium waiting on its first host of master auteurs. Though I agree that the current crop of hop-on-the-bandwagon atrocities don't benefit very much from these optical effects, the kid inside me can't help to enjoy it just a bit, even as my outer adult is sick and tired of all the ballyhoo. Do you think it's possible, Joe, that 3D, from all the problems that it's got, that someone will go, you know what, I can do something with this and it will be different?
Well,
and maybe you are it.
I presume that a lot of people have seen Avatar. Avatar is the current state of the art of 3D. Now, this is an unusual situation in that very few people have years to gestate about how they're going to do their movie. And here's a guy who had a movie he wanted to make and he had to wait until the technology caught up with him. Stanley Kubrick used to do that also. Avatar is, aside from being a collection of more cliches than I've ever seen together in one movie, is quite an amazing concoction. It's created a world that couldn't be possible in any other medium, and which some people like so much that they want to live in it. That people go back to the movie because they actually find it more attractive than their real lives. Now, Peter Pan did that for me when I was a kid, but that was different. I think that it is the harbinger of something new, but I don't think that your average cheeseball ripoff goes to India and comes back in dark and flickery is the future of 3D. And I think that eventually they'll either start labeling these pictures as real 3D versus fake 3D, or else people will just get the message. They will go, we're not gonna go unless we know that this is something worthwhile. And as the idea of auteurs doing 3D, Hitchcock was one of the last 3D movies in the old iteration in the 50s, Dial M for Murder, which very few people saw in 3D.
But it barely got released in 3D.
It played anywhere because it was too late. But the fact is that when you see the movie today, it is a remarkable use of 3D, and it was certainly what I based my use in The Hole on, because it's it uses the space emotionally, which is something that can be done. It just isn't often.
Dan, on this email, I just felt I had to email to say Mr. Dante is truly one of the biggest reasons why I am as obsessed with cinema as I know I am. Brackets, BA Honours Film Studies. I saw Inner Space as an 8-year-old and instantly fell in love. I can honestly say I look back at that film the way others look back at Star Wars. Great to have Joe back making films. Is there any chance he can get Dennis Quaid involved and bring Tuck Pendleton back to the big screen?
Well, it's lovely to hear, and many people now are big fans of Inner Space, but when it came out, unfortunately, there were very few fans of Inner Space, partly because it had one of the worst titles ever and one of the worst ad campaigns, but people found it later on home video, a phenomenon which I think is also going to be difficult to reproduce, because the idea of discovering movies again in their second life. Movies don't have a second life anymore because of the lack of the DVD market is going away. The shops are shuttering, and every movie has to be on demand, and it's going to have to be sent to your machine, and you're going to have to know about it. Somebody's going to have to tell you about the billions and billions of movies in the libraries that are going to be available. We have more movies available now than we've ever had in anybody's lifetime, and yet there's so little known about most movies that happened before 1990, that there needs to be a clearinghouse where people say, look, here's a whole bunch of really important movies that you have to go see, because otherwise you won't know about them. That's one of the reasons I started my website, Trailers from Hell, because it's to show people that there are places to go to find commentary about movies that they've maybe never heard of and should be directed toward.
And will that make your job in future easier or more difficult?
My job as directing?
Yeah, absolutely. The fact that, as you say, if the DVD market is disappearing,
well,
the
it's
fact
already
that everything is going to be on demand, will that make your job as a director making pictures?
If you're lucky enough to get one, it won't it won't make much difference. But the fact is that there will be less jobs because there will be less pictures. There are already less pictures because one of the ways in which movies, even the ones that aren't successful at the box office, which is the larger percentage of them, are still made, is because there's a plan that at the end of their run they will go to DVD and they can recoup their costs worldwide. And this has been a pretty good formula for a long time, but the formula is now dying. And so as a result, there are less people who are inclined to invest in a marginal movie, and which is why you've seen the loss of the mid-range movie. The movies are now either super cheap or
super
very
expensive. But it's interesting because, I mean, Cleopatra theoretically went into, which is widely cited as the biggest flop of all time, went into profit either in 1973 thanks to the $5 million TV sale or in 1986 due to the video then sell-through. Even with movies that lost money as spectacularly as that, it was considered that the backstop of the small screen would in the end pay for them. It was just how long it would take them to pay for them. But you're saying that actually that's going to go away.
I think that's their fear, and I think that's one of the reasons you see such volatility in the movies and the movies that are made and the movie and the way they're marketed. The people who make movies literally don't know where these pictures are going to be shown or what their futures are going to be. And so they're very conservative what they make, and that's why you see so many remakes and reboots and sequels and titles that sell themselves and don't need to be explained, because it's just easier for them. And it costs so much money now to open a movie, to pay for the prints and pay for the ads, that a lot of people just opt to do, let's just not make it.
Can I just say before I forget that one of the scariest moments in Hole, which is the reason why you're here, is the appearance of Quinn Lord. I will say no more, but people should check that out, because I was thinking, wow, that's disturbing, and now I understand why.
Well, if there are any Mario Bava fans in the audience, they will find, I think, a number of references to one of his greatest works, Kill Baby Kill.
Scott in East Sussex, Scott Innes, I'd like to take this opportunity to say thank you to Joe Dante for making what is, in my opinion, the greatest comedy of all time. This despite the fact that it was largely pummeled by critics on its release 21 years ago. I am talking, of course, about The Burbs, featuring Tom Hanks before he was a household name, Bruce Dern as a former soldier obsessed with the toilet habits of a neighbour's dog who is in your mood, who's back in Hole. Corey Feldman before he descended into madness. I'm continually depressed that this little gem of a film gets zero attention. My friend and I quite literally quote every line of the film from start to finish. I'd be interested to know if Mr. Dante has any affection for the film at all, or is it one due to the reception it received, one he'd sooner forget?
Well, it's true. It was very poorly received and, in fact, got the worst reviews of any movie I ever made. In fact, you do remember really, really bad reviews. They do stick with you. And the one in the New York Times has stuck with me. And it says, as empty as a movie can be without actually creating a vacuum. And oddly enough, in ensuing years, it has become astoundingly popular. People do have screenings where they shout out the dialogue, and there's websites devoted to it. And, you know, it's become a bona fide cult movie, which is remarkable because it didn't really make a ripple when it was new. And it's one of the illustrations of my theory, which is that you can't necessarily judge the worth of a movie at the time it's released because there are so many other issues around what the world is like and what the society is like and what other movies there are and, you know, all that. We have to let some time pass before you can really see what a movie is like. So many of our favorite movies were movies that were dismissed when they were new. You know, Citizen Kane was dismissed and The Wizard of Oz.
It's a Wonderful Life was dismissed.
It's a Wonderful
Life. Shawshank Redemption lost money in the cinemas.
Yeah.
Joe, we're out of time. What we do next is we're going to do the box office top 10. Okay, and then we're going to do some new reviews. But I'd like you to stay until the number 9 position, which is Piranha 3D, only because of your involvement in Piranha.
Explain to Joe that I've been away for a month, so that's why there's a big hole in which of these I've seen, because I've been away.
But I imagine Piranha 3D you were shown a special screening of.
No. In fact, I wasn't invited to the premiere, if there was a premiere.
But you have seen it?
No.
Well, there's no point in you staying there. You might as well go.
Sorry.
I kind of assumed, you being Piranha Man, that they'd have had...
No, they asked me to be in it. James Cameron and I were supposed to play sea captains or something who were going to give advice to the kids about safety. And neither Jim, for his own reasons, didn't do it. And I was just not available. And so we're not in it. So all I know is what I've seen in the trailers and what I've read, it was remarkably well received critically in America. It's surprisingly, reviews were, everybody thought it was a jolly romp.
Yes.
But people, unfortunately, didn't particularly go.
But that should be the review. You know, Piranha 3D, Joe's not in it. That's the review.
That'll do. Okay, in which case you've fulfilled your function. Joe, really appreciate you coming in. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Kermode and Mayo's film review. The UK Cinema Top 10.
5 Live.
Box office top 10 this week. Inception at 10.
Great proof that you don't have to be stupid to be a really massive blockbuster movie.
Piranha 3D.
Doesn't have Joe in it.
At number 9. Doesn't have Joe. Steve in Birmingham, pithy Piranha 3D review, considering Alexandra Asia, is that how you say that?
Go ahead.
He's the director of his previous work. Not as manic and chaotic as I'd have wished. And the 3D conversion is often awful, but it's sufficiently gory. Enough moronic teenagers are slaughtered, and there are a good handful of laughs. And Christopher Lloyd, as a crazed scientist, is very, very welcome. A pleasant precursor to Back to the Future's re-release. Thank you.
Good.
Salt is at number 8.
No idea, been away.
Well, I have. Not as good. In fact, they
you
just
thought
got
it was rubbish.
I didn't think it was rubbish.
You did.
I thought it was a... Okay, yes. No, well argued. Right, no, then. I realise that. You're right. Stephen in Woking went to see Salt the other night, and I have to say I was pleasantly surprised by it. In regard to Simon's comments last week, I'm an avid fan of spy shows such as 24. Nonetheless, I thoroughly enjoyed the experience, especially after being disappointed by the A-Team and the Expendables. The action was efficiently directed and, best of all, didn't suffer from the infamous shaky camera syndrome. Despite the ending being a bit of a letdown considering what had preceded it, the pacing was sufficient and it never felt dull. Angelina looked good too, says Stephen in Woking. The Expendables at number 7.
Haven't seen it in a
while. David Anthony, Dear Mist and More Mist. I wonder whether you felt the latest Stallone fight fest should have been called the Not-So-Expendables. I felt the mix of A to D list actors all considered themselves too A-list to be expended in the story. Hence, unlike the Dirty Dozen where lots get bumped off, sorry, spoiler alert, the Expendables completely lacked tension because none of them were expended.
The Non-Expendables, I'd pay to see that.
The Switch is at number 6.
It's the best artificial Inception rom-com of the week.
Still.
Yeah. All right. Well, because this week the backup plan comes out on DVD, and that's not as good.
Scott Pilgrim versus the World is at number 5.
Was going to see it. Had to go and see Gaspar Noé's Enter the Void, which was a real head-scrambling affair. And actually, I wanted to see Scott Pilgrim, so I'm now going to see Scott Pilgrim on Sunday.
This one just gets quite interesting from Nick Cordingley, heading off to Cambridge to read history in a few weeks, because he's heard it's quite a good university.
Best university in the world, apparently.
However, he says the most interesting thing about the film, in my opinion, is its positive portrayal of a gay character, Scott's roommate Wallace. Unlike many other films, he is neither flamboyantly camp for comedy effect, nor is he having to struggle against the shackles of his narrow-minded society, the latter being something Hollywood seems to be obsessed in portraying to show how liberal it is, despite there being so few out Hollywood actors, things being comparably much better in this country. Wallace is simply presented as a character, not a gay character, happy with himself and accepted by his fellows. Says Nick Cordingley, thanks for that. Grown Ups is at 4.
Haven't seen it.
Even though it's at 4, no one sent in a review, so no one has seen it.
Good, excellent.
On the evidence of this show, no one has bothered. Toy Story 3 at 3.
Better in 2D than 3D.
Okay, I think
Dinner for Schmucks.
Are you in a hurry?
Totally awful.
Have you got people coming around for dinner?
No, I just want to get through some reviews. Totally awful in every possible way and a real headache of a film.
Rudd and... Oh, no, we won't bother with that, I don't think. Last Exorcism is at 1.
60 minutes of an interesting horror movie, 15 minutes of a totally rubbish horror movie that didn't know how to end. You have to remember one of the great things about Blair Witch Project is whether you like it or loathe it, it has got a proper ending. I mean, it ends in a way that's scary. The last 12 minutes of Last Exorcism, you go, oh, for heaven's sake.
Bill Martin says, Dear Kamenev and Zinoviev, this being a letter, having been to see The Last Exorcism this week, I'm disappointed to find myself in disagreement with a good doctor. His review of this intelligent and well-constructed film was tepid. I felt that it handled the traditional horror gothic theme of reason versus superstition in an interesting fashion.
Yeah, until the last 15 minutes.
Rather than the traditional fear of the supernatural, it threw down the gauntlet to the religiously faithful. If you believe in God, you believe in demons. Yeah. It then managed to keep the tension of the natural explanation versus the supernatural.
Until the last 15 minutes.
Throughout, and even the ending managed to avoid any overt confirmation of
what?
The demonic presence.
This, have you seen the same film? The ending managed to avoid any overt confirmation. The ending makes Star Wars look understated.
This tantalised viewers, who after all are there to enjoy the supernatural horror, by continually refuting extraordinary explanations in favour of the mundane.
Yeah. Well, honestly, if you think the ending left it open-ended, then I'm sorry. I
apologise, Bill, again, on behalf of...
Unbelievable.
My colleague here.
Yeah. Anyway, I really like those James Bond movies because they're so open-ended.
The box office top 10 has been done. New movies include the much-postered Tomorrow
Much
Drew.
Tomorrow Drew, which is Stephen Frears' adaptation of Posy Simmons' graphic novel, which started life as a cartoon. Have you read the cartoon strip? Comic strip?
I remember it from many years ago.
Do you? Yeah. I don't. I've never read it and I haven't seen the comic strip. So
you are dismissing it already, I can tell.
No, I'm not. I'm saying I don't know the comic strip. I'm just being absolutely clear about that. So I can't do it. This is how, which itself apparently was inspired by Thomas Hardy. So Roger Allam is a philandering crime novelist. I love Roger Allam. His country home is used as a writer's retreat, which is looked after basically by his long-suffering wife, who's played by Tamsin Greg, you pronounce it, don't you? And then Tamara Drew is the local girl, played by Gemma Arterton, who comes back with a new nose. Apparently when she was young, there is some history between her and the Roger Allam character, but she comes back wearing hot pants and sporting a new nose, where she sets everyone's hearts aflame and everyone's pulses are racing.
She is Gemma Arterton
and starts having a ding-dong with a rock star. Roger Allam is devious. Tamsin Greg is long-suffering. Here's a clip.
I've been rereading Inchcombe Etherized, one of Nicholas's early books. There's a character, Theo, who's an adulterer. Theo has a list of golden rules called lulling the spouse. To allay suspicion, he says, you must first arouse it. Nicholas rang me earlier to say he was going to be late home.
Yeah, I just bumped into Raoul and Celia.
I said, oh, that's nice. And thought, have you? I couldn't shake the suspicion. So, after an hour, I phoned Raoul.
Hello? Yeah, he's right here.
And he put Nicholas straight on the line.
Hello.
He's been telling the truth a lot recently. Is he lulling me? I might remind him that in Inchcombe Etherized, Theo's wife runs him through with a carving knife.
So this is, as previously discussed, now unfilmed as Stephen Frears, as opposed to directed by Stephen Frears.
Even
now,
though he took that point reluctantly.
Yeah, exactly. This first played, to my knowledge, in Cannes. I was at the Cannes Film Festival when it played, and I remember being seeing it for the first time and coming out afterwards and finding out that everybody loved it. And it's a huge hit as far as critically is concerned. The posters are all over the place saying, you know, feel-good film of the year. So it's, you know, it is embraced by many people, and I have read many things, people saying that they have read the original comic strip, and it's very, very faithful to it. I don't know, because I haven't read the original strip cartoon, so I can't tell you how faithful it is. Here's what I think. I think Tamsin Gregg, great. I think that Roger Allam is great. I mean, I can watch Roger Allam in almost anything. I think that it has a series of really, really fine films. Gemma Arterton is shaping up as a really, really talented actress. I have to say that as far as the swooning that's concerned around Tamara Drew is concerned, I feel exactly the same way as I did about The Queen. I don't get it. And the reason I don't get it is, well, there's a number of reasons. One of the things is that, you know, it looks terribly televisual to me. I know I said this about The Queen. It's a TV movie. That's what it looks like. More importantly, here's a quote from Stephen Frears in the production notes. He's talking mid-edit. He said, "I haven't worked it all out yet. It takes me a very long time before I can answer the question, what kind of film is it? But I'm very pleased at how funny it is. And I can only say, I can see that it deals with some sort of dreadful things. I can only apologise." The interesting thing was, what he's basically saying is, in the middle of the edit, he didn't really know what kind of film it was, and he sort of found the film in the edit. My problem with Tamara Drew is this. It may well be that if you're very familiar with the subject matter, with the comic strip, you know exactly where you are. I spent an awful lot of Tamara Drew going, what kind of film is this? On the one hand, there are broadly bawdy comic elements, which are played almost as slapstick humour. On the other hand, there are elements which do with death and grief and cheating, which sit very awkwardly alongside the sort of bawdy comic elements. There are times in which there are, like, Dominic Cooper and Tamsin Gregg appear to be in totally different films. The rock star character is being played as, you know, very broad, oh, I'm a rock star, yeah, blimey, Charlie, blah, 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 blah. The Tamsin Gregg character really is genuinely somebody who's suffering as a wife. And all this kind of comes to a head in the sort of, there's a tragi-comic denouement, which I can't talk about in a way because I imagine everybody knows the story, but I'm working on the Dumbledore principle. You never want to tell anybody anything because actually people don't know as much as you do know. I spent the whole film thinking this looks like a film that is pulling in three different ways. Bits of it are funny. Individual elements of it are well done. There's a sort of scene-stealing performance by two young schoolgirls who offer a running commentary on the action, very sort of bawdy and foul-mouthed, and actually did raise lots and lots of laughs, and they were actually the most entertaining thing about the film. But as for the film itself, it had that British picturesque quality written all the way through it, albeit in a sort of slightly, oh, actually, we're making a British class satire, you know, satirical movie. It's undermining that lovely view of British country life, and yet it isn't really. It did feel terribly televisual. It did feel like every single scene came from a different film, and they'd all somehow been stuck together, and somehow in the construction of putting them together, you thought, oh, well, there's a film, and what is it? Oh, it's a comedy. It's a broad comedy, but there are things in it that don't fit into that, so let's leave them in anyway because that's kind of how they sit. And worse still, there is a sense of, although it's satirical and although people have said, oh, you know, it's all about undermining the, there is a sense of smugness about it. There is, I mean, the Posy Simmons thing, I imagine, appeared originally in a broadsheet publication.
I think it was in The Guardian.
Yeah, so there is a Guardian reader sense about it. And I say this, you know, as the person that you've referred to as a person who only knows two publications in the world, The Guardian and Fangoria, which is untrue. I also am very familiar with a magazine called Hair Products Monthly. But there is something about it, which is that you feel like I'm sitting there watching it in Cannes. It was like the hand-picked audience. It was the people who get this joke and who find these people, you know, charming and interesting and funny, but also you're trying to get under their skin. I mean, I have read pieces about this that say, oh, yes, it has that, you know, getting under the British. I'll tell you what it looks like. It looks like, do you remember there was a French film of an Alan Ayckbourn comedy?
I know the answer is going to be no, but carry on.
Okay, I think it was Smoking, No Smoking, in which they were taking, I think that's what it was, in which they were taking a broadly uninteresting British comedy and saying, oh, well, inside it, there's all this kind of interesting social commentary. I would love to be able to tell you that I get why people are falling over themselves about Tamara Drew. I really don't.
And might that be you?
You know, it might be me, but honestly, when I watch it, I go, it's televisual, it's all over the place, the scenes don't hang together in terms of coherence of tone, the individual performances are great, there are individual elements in it that are really good, but it doesn't have a unifying voice, and it is, at its worst, guilty of a form of smugness, which I find very annoying about British filmmaking.
Is it funny?
I laughed.
Plenty
of times.
Well, that's fine then.
Yeah, fine.
It's a funny film. It's a comedy.
There are things in it that are funny. It's everything else that I don't get. And most of the things in it that are funny are the two girls, the two young girls being, you know, ridiculously talking in a way that's totally inappropriate. Incidentally, the BBFC report, which says, because it's whatever certificate it is, it says strong language, strong sex references, over 30 uses of strong language they refer us to.
Just so that you know.
Just so you know.
But normally on a 15, you know what you're going to get. And if it's 12...
It must be a 15. So, but I'm sorry. I'd love to be able to embrace it. I don't.
Gemma Arterton is in lots of really good things, though, isn't she? I mean, she is clearly...
Very good.
She's clearly the actress of the moment.
She is, and she's very good. I mean, she's been in some stuff in which she's not very good. I mean, she tried very hard in Clash of the Titans, but there was nothing really to do. But she's very good. But Roger Allam is brilliant. Tamsin Gregg is brilliant. These people are brilliant. Their performances are great.
Is it less than the sum of its parts?
Yes, it really is, because the sum of its there are several parts, and they don't hand together. Tell you what it looks like. It looks like the kind of thing that Udo Kier would have cooked up in that 1973.
No, really?
You know, you strap an arm from this, a bit from that, and look, and somehow it's alive, and it shambles all over the place. But I have to be honest, I sat in a screening room in Cannes in which people were clearly loving it, and I just felt like it's me, right?
It's the thing to say as you walk out, you know, looks just like the kind of thing Udo Kier would have cooked up in the 60s. 70s. No, but in the 60s, you know, that's even more impressive.
Even worse.
We have some movies to get through between now and 4 o'clock, but thank you to Matthew, BSc Honours, Salford, brackets not in the top 100, I've got the whole chart here, actually. Something that might end the bickering or hopefully kick it up a notch, he says. In the same list that places Cambridge as the world's top university, Manchester comes in at 30, whereas Warwick can only manage a pathetic 53. So there you go.
Where's Southampton?
A review, and I'll just see if it goes down that far.
Okay, so I'm going to do two things together, which is my son...
81.
There you go. My son, what have ye done? And The Runaways together because of the linking factor of Michael Shannon. My son, what have ye done? I have to say it like that because the first time I ever heard the title was when Werner Herzog said to me that was the name of his new film. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm making a horror movie with David Lynch. It's called My Son, What Have You Done? I can't not say it like that.
It would be very irritating, though, if you repeated that three times.
So it's Herzog directing, David Lynch producing. There was Herzog said this thing to me when we were doing this on stage. He said that he was outraged. He had come over about a year and a half ago when he was first doing this. He said there had been an article in the American press which he took exception to, in which it had described the two of them working together as the probably mad David Lynch and the certifiably mad Werner Herzog. And he was absolutely... He said, you know, honestly, how dare they say this, the certifiably mad Werner Herzog, okay? So the story of My Son, What Have Ye Done is Michael... Sorry, I'm going to have
what
to
What have
you
done? It's quite
no,
straightforward.
No, have ye done. Have, ye okay. done, what not you. What have ye done? It's not straightforward. My Son,
it's
What Have Ye Done.
It's a stupid title.
And Michael Shannon, at the beginning of the movie, has killed his mother, played by Grace Zabriskie. He then holds up in his house. Willem Dafoe turns up as the cop, trying to get him out of the house. Meanwhile, various people, Chloe Savini, who plays his fiancé, Udo Kier, who plays his drama teacher, turn up to explain in flashback how we got to the point where this thing has happened. As we discover in flashback, there has been a sort of Norman Bates-like relationship between child and mother. The mother is incredibly overbearing, attempts to force the child to eat jello. The child himself has gone and explored his inner turmoil by going off and doing this Greek tragedy in which their matricide is involved. He's become very affected by a sword. The whole thing has that Herzogian. I mean, I understand why
Herzogian.
Yes, I understand why Herzog was offended. But actually, if you saw My Son, What Have Ye Done, you'd understand that actually saying that somebody in relation to it was slightly mad isn't completely out of the ballpark. I mean, the fact of the matter is, David Lynch apparently was very hands-off, but there are huge Lynchian elements all over it. It's Herzogian and Lynchian, in the same way that...
How would you spot the difference between a Lynchian bit and a Herzogian
bit? It's interesting to try and distinguish them, isn't it? I think the Lynchian moment would be when they arrive at the strange house with the birds outside, and the Herzogian moment would be in which the guy explains to you why it is that they're on an ostrich farm. I think that's the difference between the two. One of them is visual, one of them is verbal. You have, I mean... In it, you have this central performance by Michael Shannon, which really holds the thing together. Michael Shannon is one of the maddest screen presences around at the moment. That's not to say he is mad.
That's three madnesses.
No, exactly. He has a really, really intense... I mean, actually, you look back at his, you know, his career. We first saw him in Bug, in which he plays somebody who goes mad. He was in World Trade Center, in which he's the guy who gets mad. He was in Revolutionary Road, in which he's the guy who is mad. And now he's in this, in which he's the guy who becomes crazy, and then other people come in. I mean, he's so crazy that when Udo Kier comes in to explain how his craziness happened. Udo Kier is considered to be the sane one. He's the person who you put him next to Udo Kier, and actually his behaviour is okay. And you have this incredibly intense performance by Michael Shannon. You also have that classic Herzogian thing that at one point we go off and we hear Brad Dourif talking about ostriches. And Brad Dourif, who of course famously played Billy Bibbit in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and is known for playing crazy, and of course in X's 3 plays, you know, patient X, who of course is the incarcerated inmate and has done a good number of crazies in his time. The weird thing about it is, I don't think it's a great movie by any means. There are things, I mean, I would watch any Herzog movie. I'm even going to watch the Herzog 3D cave movie, because if anyone's going to do something with 3D, then I'm very happy to see Herzog do it. It has that strange, disjointed, awkward quality which Herzog's movie have, and when you watch certain scenes, you think, is that bad? Or is it Herzogian? Particularly when Udo Kier is leading you into flashbacks. And Udo Kier is going, yes, well, it was very interesting because he came over to my drama class and then we were going to do the Greek tragedy. And I said, you know, the Greek tragedy, which is about the killing of the mother. And he was very interested. I remember the time when he... And then suddenly we get back...
It's like a camp SS officer that you were doing there.
It's Udo Kier. It's Udo Kier. It's, you know, to know death, Otto. It's him. It's the guy from Flesh for Frankenstein. It's the guy who in my book I cast as Mr. Niet, because he's the most bonkers screen presence in the world. I think in the end,
what's your book called again?
It's called Simon Hasn't Read Me Yet.
No, the full title.
I'm not going to do that. In My Son, What Have You Done, what you get is the Herzogian elements and the Lynchian elements and the strong performances. I don't think it adds up to very much in the end, but whilst it was there, I was diverted by it. However, it has the Michael Shannon madness, and then, which brings us on to The Runaways, in which Michael Shannon plays Kim Fowley, who's the Svengali figure. Were you a Runaways fan?
No, not particularly.
You know, but you're familiar with their work.
I am indeed familiar with, well, not a lot of work to be familiar with, but no, I'm familiar with who they are and what they did and what she didn't wear.
In a way, the interesting thing is exactly what you said. That only in a way. There isn't a lot. The story of The Runaways is actually fairly flimsy, which is that they wanted to be pop stars. Kim Fowley came along and sort of said, I can make you into pop stars. They became pop stars, and then they all fell apart. In fact, it's pretty much the same story as Slade in Flame, only obviously the characters in this don't have big sideburns.
Yes.
Look better in pants than perhaps Noddy Holder did. That said...
That's a matter of opinion, obviously.
I enjoyed The Runaways. I know that it's not a fantastically... complex or original story, but what I enjoyed about it was this. On a performance level, for a start, I think Shannon was absolutely brilliant, as he always is. I mean, his performance as Kim Fowley is terrific. He is charismatic. I mean, he's the guy who says, you know, it's not about women's lib, it's about women's libido, and he's the guy who's actually feeding them all this stuff that they're then having to regurgitate on stage. And the film is very clear about the manipulation of that character, which incidentally is the same character as the Tom Conti character from Slade in Flame. It's nominally based on the book by Cherry Curry, who therefore, you know, her story is told, you know, with a certain amount of honesty. And Dakota Fanning is terrific. Dakota Fanning is, you know, really does a very good job of doing somebody who's nobody and then becomes somebody and then sort of falls over because fame and flashbulbs come calling, as do all the other things. But the real eye-opener was Kristen Stewart, who is absolutely terrific as Joan Jett. And one of the reasons that she's so good is that she, I mean, there's not a whole lot
does
to
she
do.
Smile?
No, she doesn't smile. Oh, she's good. Being Joan Jett. But you've met Kristen Stewart. She doesn't do smile, does she?
Well, I haven't met her.
Smiles in the third Twilight film once.
Does she?
But the funny thing is that, you know, it's every now and then you see a film in which you think, in order for this film to work, and particularly with rock biopics, somebody's going to have to get the physical presence of that character right. And whatever else you may think about Kristen Stewart, whether you think she's a great actress or not a great actress or whatever, I mean, I happen to think that she's actually pretty decent. She gets the Joan Jett thing down pat. It's not just that the wig's right or that the leather jacket's right or that the sunshine. She actually gets that aura of Joan Jett of being... In a way, you look at it and you go, oh, that's interesting. That's exactly what Joan Jett is. She's the mopey teenager who's a bit cross, looking out at you from under her fringe, but actually not taking the front line in the band, because that's Cherry Curry doing that. So although I don't think there's a huge amount of insight, I thought the way the music was done seemed to be convincing. I really enjoy the character of Kim Fowley as played by Michael Shannon. I thought Kristen Stewart did a pretty damn good job of doing Joan Jett, which is not the easiest thing in the world to do. So despite going in with fairly low expectations, I thought, you know, it's incidental in the same way that the Herzog film is incidental, but you know what? It was fine.
So I'm just checking this.
Yes.
Durham University,
mm-hmm.
One of our great universities.
I'm sure it's marvellous.
Is ranked lower than Dartmouth College. Just I've mentioned that.
I don't understand that list.
Well,
is it alphabetical?
Well, as
Durham is after Dartmouth in the alphabet. Is that how it works?
As Mike in Leeds has pointed out, don't worry, there'll be another league table out next week which will say something entirely different.
Yes.
This is Five Live, and as the advert proclaimed, we're in Newcastle next week. So
Newcastle.
Seeing everybody.
You have to say Newcastle because Sting gave me a really hard time once. When you were there.
Yeah, so, but it's just nonsense, isn't it?
Because that's what he says. He says, I said it's from Newcastle. He went, no, it's not. It's Newcastle. It's like, all right.
But it's like...
It's London, actually.
Yeah, but Lansing, for example, if you live in Lansing, you say Lansing.
Fine. Well, you go there and you say Newcastle and you see what Sting thinks of it. Actually, let's call it Newcastle just to annoy Sting.
Do you know what? I don't really care what
Sting thinks.
Exactly,
because since his adventures with the loot, none of us care.
Suzanne Chandler's Ford in Eastleigh, listening to Mark's review, compelling as ever. His sentiments entirely... This is over tomorrow, Drew.
Oh, good.
His sentiments entirely echoed my feeling about the original Guardian cartoon, smug, smug and smug. Never could understand why the cartoon was apparently so critically acclaimed. And this from Alan in Belfast. Mark, I would like to thank you for making our house a much fresher smelling place.
Oh, dear.
When listening to the podcast on my cycle into work, I was listening avidly to your magnificent rant about dinner with schmucks.
Rant
was a little nugget about finding old food under the sofa. This got me thinking, as we have a very bad smell in our kitchen. When I got home, I had a good dig around under the sink, and lo and behold,
old
falling
food
down the back of the cupboard was a slowly...
It's a video copy of Dinner for Schmucks.
Was a slowly rotting apple. I love the way you interrupt listeners' emails.
Sorry.
Now disposed of, our kitchen smells much sweeter. Thank you very much.
Indeed. Good. Excellent.
He goes on with lots of comments about 3D, which we haven't got time for just at the moment, because here comes a new movie.
Going the Distance, which is directed by Nanette Bernstein, who made American Teen, which I wasn't crazy about, but also Kid Stays in the Picture, I think. Somewhat bawdy rom-com starring Drew Barrymore and Justin Long. Justin Long is the dorky guy who was broken up from his girlfriend. He works in a record company, which he doesn't really like doing. He goes to a bar where just like in real life, right? He goes to a bar and he happens to meet Drew Barrymore, who, just like in real life, is actually really interested in video games, just the same as he is. And so he then takes her back to his place where, just like in real life, she really enjoys the fact that he lives with a really dorky, foul-mouthed flatmate who, just like in real life, enjoys playing the Top Gun theme tune whilst they are involved in some canoodling. Here's a clip.
Where's that coming from?
Dan.
How's Top Gun music playing?
Dan!
Hey, Garrett.
I am so sorry. I forgot to tell you that Dan's also my roommate.
You guys live together?
Yeah.
Hey, Dan.
Hello in there.
Dan, what are you doing?
Watching every motion in my Foolish Lovers game?
What was our rule?
Just because I can hear you through the wall doesn't mean I get to participate.
Right, and what were you doing just now?
Participating.
Okay.
Look, man, I just thought maybe, you know, it'd be fun if I DJ'd your hookup.
I'm really sorry.
I'm gonna go.
Listen. I can explain.
Yeah? Explain.
You know what? I can't. I really have no save here. He's
That's
a moron.
You know what? I was totally pretending to be mad because I didn't want you to think I was slutty. I don't care at all.
Oh.
I think it's kind of awesome.
Really? Well, that's weird.
In fact, Dan, take me to Berlin.
Here it comes.
And that's the central conceit of the movie. It's like, do you remember that advert when, I can't remember what it was for, but it was an advert in which, you know, everything works out better than you can expect. And it had a scene in it in which a sort of a young, very attractive woman turns to a guy and says, "That's amazing. I love comic books too." And it was that, you know, that idea that, you know, the male idea of what he would want from a woman. And in many ways, that's what's going on in this. He goes,
I don't remember that ad, no.
No, I can't remember what it was an advert for, but, you know,
she's into
yeah, probably the Radio Times. She's into video games. She thinks the whole Top Gun is cute. She thinks the fact that he has these slubby flatmates is cute. Fine. So that, and there has been a general coarsening of, teen romance comedies, which I think to some extent, you know, comes from Judd Apatow, but you can go all the way back to Kevin Smith. I remember seeing Clerks for the first time and being genuinely amazed by how rude it was. And actually, you know, there's been a quantum shift that now even the most generally amiable rom-coms have got, you know, quite a lot of talk about stuff that they wouldn't have been talked about in the past. The world has changed around us. You know,
how did that happen?
I don't know.
I don't know.
You know, one day there was three channels, the next day there was a million. I don't know how it happened. But
and Melon Farmer is an appropriate
exactly.
word to be used at all times and in all places.
So the MacGuffin in all this is that what happens is that she actually has a job that she has to go back to, and they're going to therefore be on opposite opposite sides of the Atlantic, and are they going to be able to conduct their... Are they be able to go the distance, to conduct their relationship at a long distance? Is it going to work? Isn't it going to... So actually, it's an interesting idea, which is that they get on kind of well. They really, really like each other. They're both equally affectionate towards each other, but they're separated by distance, and can they make it work? And you know what? Again, perfectly fine. I mean, it's funny. I came out of it to hear a number of critics that I was in the screening with saying, oh, isn't that terrible? Wasn't that awful? And it wasn't terrible. It wasn't awful. I like Drew Barrymore. I mean, Drew Barrymore, incidentally, recently directed a movie quite well, that the roller derby movie that she made, the name of which fails me. Whippet, which was rather well done. Not Whippet, as in a Whippet, like in the...
Whippet, as in Devo.
Whippet good, into shape, like you know you should, or whatever the other line is. And it's perfectly fine. And there was, I was pleased, having laughed during it, to come out and see an advert for it in which James King, Radio 1, said, loved it. I thought, well, that's okay, because it's playing to the demographic it's meant to play to, and I kind of enjoyed it as well. So despite the fact that it's in the end one of those, you know, rude frat boy comedies with the edges taken off, I think it's got more appeal than that, and it's rather charming. The other thing that's out, kind of connected, is Cyrus, which has been described as mumblecore goes mainstream, or a cross between mumblecore and frat boy.
You're going to explain mumblecore?
Well, mumblecore is that sort of that branch of movies in which people... They mumble. You know, mumblecore is a musical thing. You know, shoegazing, they used to call it in indie circles, OK? So it's mumblesome filmmaking, which with that sort of, you know, verite feel to it, in which it's, I mean, maybe it's, oh, how do you, I don't know, do you got the thing with, the, I don't, but I get the, you know.
And Woody Allen.
Actually, would Woody Allen have counted as mumblecore? No, because I think he has too many actual sentences with beginning, middles, and
ends.
That
was your impression, though. It was your Woody Allen.
Oh, I see. Fine. That's all my impressions. I can either do Woody Allen or Danny Dyer or the Camp Hollywood guy. They all sound the same. They're all like that. Doesn't matter what I do. Mumblecore, it's like that, but it's a little bit like that. That's how I do mumblecore.
Good flappy hand
action
there.
So John C. Reilly is a divorcee. This is actually, in many ways, interesting. He's a divorcee, right? He goes to a party. He's a, you know, schlubby guy who describes himself as looking like Shrek. And when he's at the party, just like in real life, he bumps into Marisa Tomei, who, just like in real life, when that guy meets that woman, says, oh, I really find you attractive. And the next thing you know, just like in real life, they're having a ding-dong. But the fly in the ointment is that she has a son, Cyrus, played by Jonah Hill, who actually has a Norman Bates thing going on, which ties it back somewhat to my son, what hath he done? And is working slyly from within to destroy his mother's relationship because, in a true Freudian nightmare style, he doesn't want anybody else to share his mother's affections. Here's a clip.
I don't want to say a thing because Molly asked me not to, but I think you might be coming on a tad too strong.
Wow, I mean, I don't want to get into it, but those were not the signals I was getting at all tonight.
In the past, when she's losing interest, she tends to overcompensate sexually. I just think that if you pulled back 10 to 20% emotionally speaking, you'd do a lot better for yourself.
So he's basically attempting to undermine the relationship which is happening with his mother, and he's doing it in a way which at times borders on the sort of psycho intensity. It's a very interesting thing. See, Jonah Hill, I haven't been a huge fan of in the past. He's been in lots of those movies that I really don't like, in which it's, you know, it is the frat boy foul mouth of suddenly this is how we were all meant to talk, and it doesn't work for me. But what you've had here is like all of that turned down, because it's the guys who made the puffy chair. The dials are all turned down. So essentially, you have that sort of, you know, that verite intimacy. It almost borders on indie spirit going on with sort of the external trappings of a loud foul-mouthed comedy. And the interesting thing here is, I don't know, have you seen the poster? And the poster is Marisa Tomei and John C. Reilly and Jonah Hill all together looking like, you know, like a group. And then there's a tagline which I can't repeat because it's, you know, it's seriously don't do this to, you know, with it to his mum. And the poster makes it look like the guy's making an obscene hand gesture. And the poster looks like the most awful, bawdy, you know, all those things that I really don't like. And
is
I
it
understand.
Porkies?
Well, no, actually, the Porky's poster is relatively understated in comparison with the humour of that.
Does it make you think that's what it's going to be?
Yes, it does. It makes you think, well, that it's going to be one of those Judd Apatow movies, which it isn't, although clearly it is inflected by that, and clearly, you know, his stamp is on it. What's interesting is that in order to get the audience in, they've had to sell it to the audience in that way. And I think they're going to have an interesting case, which is that people are going to see Cyrus. You're yawning. I don't believe you just yawned in the middle of this.
Well, you've been going on a bit.
okay, well, I think that what's going to happen is people are going to go and see this film expecting one kind of film. They're actually going to get another kind of film, which is going to sort of, you know, somewhat confuse them. And I don't think that's going to help the movie. I think I understand why you publicise a movie in a certain way to get an audience in, but I think that the poster is misleading. And if you want a real tone of what the film is like, think Catherine Keener. In fact, the film, the tone of the film would better be served by having a picture of Catherine Keener and going, you know her? It's like one of the movies she'd be in, as opposed to going, you know those other guys? It's like one of the movies they'd be in.
Fine, very good. My use of the word melon farmer a few moments ago was a reference to a dubbed version of a sweary film.
Yes.
And the team who bring you Drive in a couple of moments would like you to know that they have a melon farmer on the show.
A genuine melon farmer?
Someone who farms melons.
The interesting thing about melon farming, do you know where melon farmer comes from originally? Do you know, as far as I understand, the first film to use the melon farmer dub was Repo Man, the Alex Cox movie, which of course was particularly profane in its language. And I think that was the first, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong and email me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty certain that melon farmer was actually coined for for the Alex
Cox
film.
There isn't time for that.
Okay.
Daniel Hewitt says, are you going to review the new 3D Resident Evil, or will you just be doing independent films this
week? Fine, can I do Resident Evil? Okay, so Resident Evil Afterlife, which is Resident Evil 4, directed by Paul W.S. Anderson. Paul W.S. Anderson, as opposed to P.T. Anderson, used to be a person who made proper films, okay? He used to make he made Event Horizon, which I still like. Funnily enough, I saw a bit of Event Horizon.
Don't talk about Event Horizon, talk about 3D Resident Evil.
Okay, fine,
Evil.
So this is the fourth installment in something which is based on a video game. The plot is, you know, all over the place, but basically, Mila Jovovich is still alive. The world has been overrun by zombies. There's zombies everywhere. Their heads open up and stuff's come out. Mila Jovovich crashes her plane on the top of a building where there are some non-zombie survivors, and they've basically got to get from their building to another place, which is where they think they're going to escape to and have a happy life. That's pretty much the story. So it's like a video game. It's like you're in the plane, you're on the building, you've got to get from the plane to the other place. It's terribly perfunctory. It's put tab A in slot B. I've seen all the Resident Evil movies. I couldn't tell you for one moment what distinguishes the plot of each of them, but of all of them, it is certainly not the worst. It is a perfectly perfunctory franchise movie. It is in 3D, and I gave up with the 3D. I did the thing of taking the glasses off and watching most of it in good old-fashioned 2D, and it's demonstration for me that 3D doesn't work, and I think Paul W.S. Anderson, come on, you made Event Horizon, you can do better.
Biscuit-tainment update from James. I ate 18 Jaffas in the first hour, just 5 in the second, just 1 to go now, but I might be sick. Movie of the week.
Complicated, isn't it?
Well, you've had a week to think about it.
I don't know. I mean, probably my son, what have you done? And the Runaways on a double bill.
Well, that's it for this week's podcast. I thought it was okay. What do you think?
I thought it was better than that, but
it's about okay.
I did all the work and you just sat there and yawned.
As ever, that is the point. Well, you had been going on a little bit tedious at times.
I'm sorry. Go Cambridge.
On digital and online. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Kermode and Mayo's film review.
You can get more of my film reviews, anecdotes and opinions by visiting my uncut blog. Head to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode.